New York City, in the year 2022. Nothing runs anymore. Nothing works. But the people are the same. And the people will do anything to get what they need.
This is the police!
What they need most is Soylent Green.
Oh! Fantastic! Soylent Green is 2022. What could possibly go wrong?
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight. I got the feeling that something ain't right.
Oh, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Hey there. Here I am from Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles. This is the broadcast as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, 98.7 in Santa Barbara, 93.7 in San Diego, 99.5 in Ridgecrest and China Lake. Also in California, in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI, Round Mountains KKRN and Eureka's KGOE. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, Eugene's KEPW, in Lancaster, Pennsylvania on WLRI, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, Columbus, Ohio's WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, Seattle's KODX, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF, not to mention the fact that we stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, Workforce Rising, No Lies Radio, Verdant Square Radio, and Detour Talk, blanketing planet Earth 5 days a week. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much joining us for yet another new year. On Monday, it was confirmed. New York's Attorney General has issued subpoenas to former President Donald Trump and, which we didn't know before, by the way, we didn't know before at all that his two eldest children have also been subpoenaed by Attorney General Letitia James in connection with her ongoing civil investigation into the family's allegedly fraudulent business practices going back years. That, according to a court filing unsealed by the New York State Supreme Court on Monday, confirming that, yes, all three Trumps had been slapped with subpoenas for documents and testimony on December 1. Must have been a very Merry Christmas at Mar-a-Lago. That subpoena is, quote, in connection with an investigation into the valuation of properties owned or controlled by Trump and his company, the Trump Organization. So, yeah, Happy New Year and welcome to 2022. See, it could be worse, Desi Doyen.
It could always be worse.
But we'll get there, I'm afraid.
We'll take what we can get right
now. Hope you're doing well. Hope everyone is doing well. Hope everyone is feeling good, rested, and healthy. Welcome to the broadcast where Desi and me are bothly back. Anyway, we are both back after a week off over the holidays, during which the great Nicole Sandler sat in for us for the bulk of the holiday break and offered some terrific shows in the bargain. One in particular, by the way, regarding January 6th and Merrick Garland and accountability, which I suspect we will be talking about maybe even today and certainly in the days ahead as well. Also, given the news breaking today regarding Trump and his subpoenas, I'm going to kick some planned coverage on the latest COVID news down the line as well, other than to say that I hope you have all stayed safe and healthy over the holiday break as infections continue to explode here in the U.S. Thanks to the Omicron variant, with cases now up well over 200% across the country over the past 14 days, including here in California, where we have, at least until now, we've had things relatively well under control over the past year and a half or so. And now we are seeing cases explode, whether hospitalizations and death will follow thereafter remains to be seen. But just to kick off 2022 on the right side, on the right note for the moment, before it all goes quickly south, the Trump news about the subpoenas, well, that may kick off your new year with some much needed endorphins to help get us out of the holiday stupor as we reset for what is going to be a very, very busy year, I'm afraid, and it's already busy right out of the gate. New York Attorney General James is also seeking to depose the former president and his two oldest kids as part of this probe. All three are naturally challenging those subpoenas, as Trumps do, with the disgraced former president suing the attorney general in response. That happened before the holiday break, describing her investigation as, quote, corrupt, and of course, a witch hunt, as he does. Lawyers for James's office already deposed Trump's son Eric in this same probe in late 2020 after he successfully tried to quash it. James's office is looking into whether to file a civil suit against the company in her probe, focused on whether Trump fraudulently inflated the value of his assets to secure bank loans and or fraudulently understated those assets elsewhere in order to reduce his tax bill. James's office is also involved in the separate criminal investigation, which is now being led by the new Manhattan District Attorney, Alvin Bragg. He was sworn in over the weekend on Saturday, replacing the previous district attorney, Cyrus Vance Jr., who had been supervising the criminal investigation here, but he has now left the office as of the end of the year. That office has already brought criminal tax fraud charges against the Trump Organization's chief financial officer, Alan Weisselberg, and the Trump Organization itself. They were each indicted in July as part of that criminal inquiry, and accused by Mr. Vance at the time of running a tax avoidance scheme in which executives were compensated with off-the-books benefits. There has been an additional grand jury brought together in that case to look at other elements of the Trump Organization's alleged tax fraud, one of them being the different valuations for properties that the attorney general is looking at as a civil matter, at the same time that the Manhattan District Attorney is looking at it as a criminal matter. Yes, I know it's a lot of Trump criming to keep up with, but the Trumps apparently do a whole lot of criming. And as we reported in the lead up to the holidays, a lot of those crimes are likely to cause a lot of problems for the twice impeached, disgraced former president in the new year. Even while many may be justifiably frustrated with the speed that this is happening, particularly from the U.S. Department of Justice and Merrick Garland, which we will almost certainly be discussing in the days ahead. I've got some other encouraging and not so encouraging news that I want to use to help kick off the new year here as we try to reset and get our sea legs back here. We will see how much of it I can get to today after a week off. And I'd also love, if possible, what are the chances of this, Des? I'd love to open up the phones if time allows. I'm about 50-50 chances at this point.
We shall see.
At least for a few minutes to get a sense of what you are hoping for and or hopeful about, if anything, in this new year. You can write down the number now, 818-985-5735. I am hopeful we'll be able to get to a few callers, but we will see. The old year ended actually very grimly for a bunch of folks in Colorado. As a reminder, yes, in case you forgot to watch Don't Look Up over the holidays on Netflix, as a reminder of climate change still bearing down hard on us. And I'm sorry to say, it is just getting started. On Sunday, a Colorado official said nearly 1,000 homes and other structures were destroyed. Hundreds more were damaged. Three people remain missing after an unusual and explosive December wildfire just blew up and charred a whole bunch of neighborhoods in a suburban area at the base of the Rocky Mountains outside of Denver near Boulder. Boulder County Sheriff Joe Pelley also said on Saturday that investigators are still trying to find the cause of the wind-whipped blaze that erupted on Thursday and blackened entire neighborhoods in the now very well-populated area located between Denver and Boulder. Pelley said utility officials found no downed power lines around where the fire broke out amid hurricane-force wind gusts. He said authorities were pursuing a number of tips and had executed a search warrant at one particular location, whatever that means. He declined to give details, but some in the media have been reporting that the blaze may have been originally sparked by arson. So while we don't yet know what actually sparked it, I believe we do know what is what has made it so devastating, Desi Doyen.
Yes, we do. I mean, it may be that the cause was accidental arson, as seems to be the direction that officials are looking right now.
Accidental arson?
Yeah, accidental arson, as in arson is a person starting it rather than a natural cause like lightning. So accidental arson would be somebody who was, you know, doing something that they probably shouldn't have been and sparked the fire and was unable to keep it from spreading.
I believe there was a red flag warning in place because they knew these high winds were coming.
Yes,
so there was a
red
flag warning. They weren't supposed to be making fires outside or...
causing any sparks. You know, that could also be an accidental arson cause.
Gotcha.
But regardless of what the actual, you know, proximal cause would be, I think we know that the most important cause of it is man-made global warming because the conditions in Colorado were ripe for a conflagration of this sort. And that's because of the factors that have been brought by global warming. There was record dryness in Colorado. It's in the middle of an extreme drought, nearly the entire state. Denver just had its longest snowless year on record, 232 days without snow. And then when it did finally snow in December, on December 10th, that was the first snow in 230 days. It wasn't much. And the dryness and the warmth, Denver just had its warmest December on record, which, you know, we're waiting to see if that will be confirmed. So we have a multiplicity of factors here. We've got the record warm temperatures, the record drought that is persistent, and we had incredibly high winds. Like you said, that wind event was predicted, was forecast, but I don't think they predicted hurricane force winds. 110, 115 mile per hour gusts. That's the equivalent of like a Category 2 or 3 hurricane. So that drove the fire to destroy all of these buildings within a matter of hours. And that was the other factor that has also played into this. That's a man-made factor as well. The development in all of these areas between the city of Denver and the city of Boulder that really shouldn't have been in those areas that were prone to wildfire.
And in addition to the unusually warm weather and the unusually dry conditions that have been plaguing this area. As I recall, a few years ago, didn't they have that that beetle bark bug? What is it that killed?
Oh, the pine beetle infestation.
Pine beetle,
destroyed. It's killed millions of trees across the U.S. West.
And turned them basically into matchstick. I mean, they dry out. They're in place. If they're not taken down, they're just sitting there waiting to go up in flames.
Absolutely. But let's be clear. This was an urban fire. This was not a forest fire. It was more of it was right in that place, what's called the wildland urban interface, where it changes from forest into grassland where there's more development that is now encroaching on the forest. But this was out in a grasslands area, which, you know, gave it a lot of fuel because it has been so dry.
We are going to see a lot more of these sorts of things, I'm afraid, in the days ahead, as you say, as there's been, you know, more development in many more places.
Yeah, and the building codes have not kept up with the expansion of wildfire, you know, so there will also be some investigation as to whether or not changing building codes would help to make these homes, if they're going to build in a wildfire area that's known and prone to wildfires, then change the building codes so houses don't burn so easily.
You watched Don't Look Up over the holiday break. Did you enjoy it?
I did and didn't. I would say I found it hilarious and painful.
Yes.
So it was probably, I guess, it was a bittersweet thing.
I found it painful and not hilarious. Not hilarious at all. It was quite dispiriting. And it was like, oh, okay, well, let's start a week off. Let's watch a movie. That was kind of a busman's holiday. Don't Look Up. Everyone should see it. It's
absolutely
an excellent
everybody
movie.
Should see it. It's incredibly well made. It's really funny, and it's
but
it's...
for people like us who have been shouting these warnings for going on 2 decades now, it was kind of dispiriting. I will just say
well,
that.
Yeah, okay. You might have been dispirited. I thought that, hey, maybe if people see this, it will actually help turn the mirror upon our society so that people will take action.
Well,
so.
I thought that was true, too, but I was still dispirited by it.
Anyway, I thought it was hilarious.
Yeah,
so.
Thank you very much. You know, back to, well, some maybe better news here from over the weekend, depending on how you may look at it. For some, it may be good news. For others, it may not be good news at all. This was just one of the things actually I had hoped to open the phone lines on, in addition to what you may be either most hoping for and or hopeful about in the new year at 818-985-5735. Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene's personal Twitter account was permanently suspended this weekend following, quote, repeated violations of the social media platform's COVID-19 misinformation policy. In a statement, Twitter called cited its strike system for its policy in the decision to permanently suspend the far-right lawmaker's personal account, saying that it will, quote, permanently suspend accounts for repeated violations of that policy. According to the New York Times, Green hit a fifth strike in that policy, meaning, you know, she got a fifth warning, essentially, and that her account will not now be restored after she had baselessly tweeted about, quote, extremely high amounts of COVID vaccine deaths on Saturday. COVID, not COVID deaths, COVID vaccine deaths, she claimed. She lied. Green's tweet contained a misleading chart drawing from a government database of unverified data called the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, or VAERS, as it is known to many, at least to many of the anti-vaxxers who wrongly cite or who have been hoaxed into wrongly citing the CDC's VAERS database. We've discussed this over many months now. In case you don't know, in case you haven't heard, that database relies on self-reported cases from patients and or healthcare providers, supposedly patients, supposedly healthcare providers. In other words, I can go to the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System myself today, and I can enter a record that says that the vaccine turned me into a toad.
So could I go on and I could say that, hey, I grew a third arm
yes.
out of my forehead?
Yes, you can. Yes, you can. That is the database. That would be a part of the official record that these anti-vaxxers most often cite in making their false arguments about the dangers of the vaccines. They point to that database. And because it's run by the CDC, they can say, oh, it's the government's own database. Look what we have uncovered to prove how many people are dying from the vaccine. I could say that I personally know 200 people, 2,000 people who dropped dead on the way home from getting their shots, and that would soon be, you know, cited as part of the tens of thousands of people who have died getting the shots, getting the vaccine shots, as heard on auspicious news outlets like Facebook and Fox News, and then even repeated foolishly by disinformed callers to this show from time to time. So in case you hear that, in case you hear about that database, in case you hear about those secret COVID vaccine deaths that the government doesn't want you to know about, well, that's what this is about. Previously, Twitter had issued Congresswoman Green a fourth strike back in August after a tweet baselessly claimed that vaccines were, quote, failing. Which is true if by failing she means keeping people alive. Green's third strike occurred less than a month before that one when she tweeted that COVID-19 did not pose a threat for people unless they were obsessed or over age 65, which, of course, is also true if you ignore those tens of thousands of Americans who have been killed by COVID who are under the age of 65. Green has become known for her incendiary tweets, of course, which include posting the QAnon slogan, pushing the still completely evidence-free big lie of a stolen presidential election, and comparing the House's mask policy in the U.S. House to the Holocaust. Because, you know, being forced to wear a mask to help keep other people alive is totally the same as forcing millions of citizens to wear a symbol that marks them for death by the government in concentration camps. Totally the same thing. How can you not see that, sheeple? However, Green's official congressional Twitter account that has not been suspended, at least not yet, it appears to have not violated the platform's policies. The permanent suspension of her personal Twitter account comes amid a surge in cases of the Omicron variant nationwide. Last year, of course, as you will fondly remember, I know I do, Twitter permanently banned former President Donald Trump over a risk of, quote, further incitement of violence following his supporters breaching the Capitol on January 6th on the day of the joint session of Congress certifying Joe Biden's electoral victory in Trump's last-ditch effort to steal the 2020 election through violence and mayhem. It is there that I want to take a quick break here and pick up on afterwards. But until today suddenly got so busy, I had hoped to open those phone lines. We'll see, 818-985-KPFK, to your thoughts on the permanent Twitter ban of Marjorie Taylor Greene and the idea of social media outlets banning people like her, a sitting congresswoman and a former president at all. I am curious what you think about that. Is that a good idea? Are you comfortable with a social media site like Twitter permanently removing the personal accounts of sitting members of Congress and now former presidents? For the record, as we've discussed over the years on this show, I'm not entirely comfortable with it, especially as someone who has myself. I have been temporarily suspended from Twitter for reporting on something about elections that was 100% accurate. Demonstrably so, independently verifiable. This was back in October of 2020, about a month before the election, when every election system database in the state of Georgia was failing, was found to have a flaw that kept it from working accurately with the state's new touchscreen voting systems. I reported on that on Twitter, and I was warned by Twitter that I would be not allowed to tweet unless I deleted that tweet. Now, Twitter was wrong. I was right. But I had to delete the tweet before I was allowed to use Twitter again. So I don't like the idea of some unknown panel sort of deciding what is right and wrong or accurate or not. However, that said, when it comes to things that get people killed, like lies about vaccines and diseases and calls for violence, well, I admit to being somewhat more sympathetic to such bans, even if I am trepidatious about it. Anyway, we'll see if we have time for calls on that. If anybody wants to line up, 818-985-5735. But let's take a break right here. We'll come back with a reset where in regard to that breach of the U.S. Capitol in hopes of stealing a presidential election, as this week will mark the one-year anniversary since the deadly Trump-incited attack that came really within a hair's breadth of taking down what is left of American democracy altogether. So now, as the New York Times editorial board correctly argued on New Year's Day, now every day is January 6th. And I believe they're absolutely right. That story, where it is headed, and if time, your calls are coming up on today's broadcast as the new year begins. Same place as the old year. I'm Brad Friedman, and you are listening to the Bradcast.
You're listening to the Bradcast. We are 100% listener-supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.
Some things in life are bad. They can really make you mad. Other things just make you swear and curse. When you're chewing on life's gristle, that grumble, give a whistle. And this'll help things turn out for the best. And always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life.
Yes, please do. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. And life does seem jolly rotten, doesn't it? Welcome back. Let me take a very quick call, and then I'll get on to January 6th and what I really want to talk about. Very quickly, Dan in Goleta. Hey, Dan, welcome to the Bradcast. What's up?
Hi, Brad. I just want to say real quick, the COVID thing, I was debating my libertarian brother from Alabama about this, and then he hit me with, he said that 80% of people who die from COVID are overweight or obese, and it brought me up short, and I wasn't sure how to respond, and I was wondering if you know anything about this, or if that's, because I never hear that.
Well, actually, yeah.
It's just like, is it QAnon stuff or what?
No, actually, the people who are overweight or obese are much, much more at threat from COVID. That is absolutely true. That said, I don't know what the number is. I don't know if your friend is right about your brother. About
my brother.
Yeah, I don't know if your brother is right about the 80%. But let's assume he is. If he is, that means, 20,000 will die for every 100,000 who die in this country. I think we're up to about 800,000. I think we're over 800,000 at this point. So that is, nothing to worry about. 160,000 Americans have been killed by COVID, who were not obese, even if your brother is right on that number. So not sure if that's a chance I want to take. I'm not obese, but does that help speak to your brother?
Yeah, I wanted to find out the statistic, but whatever. I mean, we get into debates, and I just wanted to run that by you.
Yeah, anyway, well, he might be correct on that number. I don't know the specific statistics, but we're talking about hundreds of thousands of people who are at risk who have no pre-existing medical conditions. If you consider being overweight or obese to be a pre-existing condition, so hopefully that helps, Dan. Thanks for that call, and Happy New Year, my friend. Let me take one more here. Harold in Santa Barbara. Hey, Harold. Welcome to the Bradcast. Happy New Year to you, sir.
Happy New Year to you. And as always, let's look at the bright side of life. This green person, I mean, this is a double-edged sword. I don't agree with her, but who determines who gets kicked off Facebook and Twitter, etc.? Who determines that?
The people who run Twitter and Facebook, etc. They're the ones who get to decide. As a private organization, they get to do what they want. Just like at bradblog.com, if I want to ban you, Harold, if you come over to bradblog.com and you start being disruptive, if you start calling for violence, if you start making knowingly false claims, I will let you know about that and ask you to stop doing that. And if you don't stop doing it, you'll eventually not be able to comment at bradblog.com.
That seems reasonable and fair.
I know. I agree. Thank you, Harold. And that's
right.
Yeah, all right. Take care. Stay on the bright side of life and Happy New Year, my friend. All right. There's a lot to get to here, and I may want to revisit this New Year's Day editorial from the New York Times editorial board, because I believe they are right on the money, or at least about as close as we seem to get these days from the corporate media. In this editorial headlined, this is from New Year's Day, headlined, "Every day is January 6th now." They begin 1 year after the smoke and broken glass, the mock gallows, and the very real bloodshed of that awful day. It is tempting to look back and imagine that we can, in fact, simply look back. To imagine that what happened on January 6, 2021, a deadly riot at the seat of American government, incited by a defeated president, amid a last-ditch effort to thwart the transfer of power to his successor. They mean to steal the election from his successor and the American people. It is tempting to look back on it as horrifying, but that it is in the past and that we as a nation have moved on. This, they write, is an understandable impulse. After 4 years of chaos, cruelty, and incompetence culminating in a pandemic and the once unthinkable trauma of January 6th, most Americans were desperate for some peace and quiet. Boy, howdy were we. On the surface, the Times writes, we have achieved that. Our political life seems more or less normal these days as the president pardons turkeys and Congress quarrels over spending bills. But peel back a layer and things are far from normal. January 6 is not in the past. It is every day. It is regular citizens who threaten election officials and other public servants who ask, quote, when can we use the guns? Really? Yes. One guy, I think it was in Florida, asked at a city council meeting, when can we use the guns? People who vow to murder politicians who dare to vote their conscience. It is Republican lawmakers scrambling to make it harder for people to vote and easier to subvert their will if they do. It is Donald Trump who continues to stoke the flames of conflict with his rampant lies and limitless resentments, and whose twisted version of reality still dominates one of the nation's two major political parties. In short, the Republic faces an existential threat from a movement that is openly contemptuous of democracy and has shown that it is willing to use violence to achieve its ends. No self-governing society can survive such a threat by denying that it exists. Rather, survival depends on looking back and forward at the same time, which I'm afraid is what we continue to endeavor to do on this show every day. And I will add, it ain't easy. Truly grappling with the threat ahead, they write, means taking full account of the terror of that day 1 year ago, thanks largely to the dogged work of a bipartisan committee in the House of Representatives. This reckoning is underway. We know now that the violence and mayhem broadcast around the world was only the most visible and visceral part of the effort to overturn the election. To steal it, New York Times editorial board. The effort extended all the way into the Oval Office, they write, where Mr. Trump and his allies plotted a constitutional self-coup, which is a fancy way of saying that they plotted to steal the election for themselves. Now, there's much more here in this editorial from the New York Times editorial board that about what needs to be done to face down this still rising threat to American democracy, including the need for federal legislation and accountability for the perpetrators, all the way up to and including the former president. And as noted, I may return to this piece in the days ahead on some of these details. But let me jump to the end here for the moment. They write, whatever happens in Washington in the months and years to come, Americans of all stripes who value their self-government must mobilize at every level. Not simply once every 4 years, but today and tomorrow and the next day to win elections and help protect the basic functions of democracy. If people who believe in conspiracy theories can win, they write, so can those who live in the reality-based world. Above all, we should stop underestimating the threat facing the country. Thank you. Countless times over the past 6 years, up to and including the events of January 6, Mr. Trump and his allies openly projected their intent to do something outrageous or illegal or destructive. Every time, the common response was that they weren't serious or that they would never succeed. How many times will we have to be proved wrong before we take it seriously, the board asks. The sooner we do, the sooner we might hope to salvage a democracy that is in grave danger. All of that coming from the New York Times editorial board, and in this case, they could not be more spot on the money, as far as I'm concerned. Now, how much the American public yet understands that, despite that editorial, despite our efforts to warn damn near every day on this show for longer than I care to remember, but it's going to continue for much longer than I even care to hope for. But how much of the American people yet understands this very real threat? That is not at all clear to me at this point. A majority of Americans condemn the January 6th riot and believe that former President Trump bears at least some responsibility for that violent attack on the Capitol. That, according to an ABC News Ipsos poll that found 72% of Americans said the people involved in the riot were mostly threatening democracy, while 25% said that those people were mostly protecting democracy.
That's delusional.
You think?
I mean, we all watched it on TV. Where was the protecting democracy part?
That's what they think they were doing. So that's a full, you know, one quarter of the American electorate that views this deadly attack on the U.S. Capitol by a Trump-incited MAGA mob to try and steal a legitimate presidential election. They consider that to be protecting democracy. Now, you might say, oh, it's only 25%, but that equates to tens of millions of Americans, often the most violent ones. You know, it's like saying, oh, 80% of those killed by COVID were obese. So why worry? This new poll also found that only 58% of people surveyed said that Trump bore a great deal or a good amount of responsibility for the Capitol riot. A majority, yes, but not an overwhelming one, 41%, said that Donald Trump bore no or just some responsibility. 41% of Americans. A majority of Americans also said that they believe that Joe Biden's 2020 presidential election victory was legitimate. That's good. 65% of Americans agree. Just 65. So that's good, I guess, because it's a majority, but still one-third, 33%, a year later, said that they think Biden's victory was not legitimate 1 year after he was inaugurated and after zero, and I mean zero, legitimate, independently verifiable evidence has been offered to even question the final results of the presidential race in any state. And believe me, I look when I see this evidence. If you've listened to the broadcast over the years, over the going on 20 years since we set up bradblog.com, you know that this is what we cover. We cover this very closely. And when I hear a claim about election fraud or even election error in a voting system or something like that, I look into it. And I have looked into these claims all over the country for the past year. And so far, I have found bupkis, nada, zero, nothing that currently makes me question the results of the 2020 election. And yet, 33% of Americans think that Joe Biden's victory was not legitimate. What's their evidence? Don't ask. The top line findings of this new poll, of course, begin to diverge along partisan lines. For example, the partisan findings are even more stark with the vast majority of Republicans, if you just focus on them. The vast majority are convinced that the election was stolen. No evidence apparently is necessary. And just 45% of Republicans believe that the people involved in the attack on the Capitol were threatening democracy. Just 45%. So a majority of the Republicans do not think that. A majority of the Republicans do believe, I guess, that those people who attacked the Capitol were actually protecting democracy. It's just astounding. In comparison, 96% of Democrats believe that those involved in the attack were threatening democracy, according to ABC's poll. Clearly, those of us in the reality-based world have a bit of work to do. Another poll out over the weekend from Morning Consult sort of underscores that. Former President Trump's efforts to overturn, to steal, Morning Consult, it's to steal. It's not to overturn. It was to steal the 2020 presidential election. Why is this so hard? I don't know. Anyway, his efforts to steal the election, culminating in the deadly riot that sought to block Congress's certification of Biden's victory on January 6th, marred voters' views on the state of the GOP and prompted questions about whether the GOP could recover in the future. Well, a year later, Morning Consult trend data paints a clear picture. It has. The GOP has recovered. They find that there is no lasting stain on the Republican brand. And though most voters, at least a 59% majority, continue to blame Trump for the events As a congressional probe homes in on him, they do not appear ready to punish Republicans for the attack on American democracy. Which is astounding to me. They will not blame Republicans. They will not hold them accountable, even though Republicans blocked a bipartisan, a completely even bipartisan commission that would have looked into the January 6th attacks. It's amazing to me. Between August of 2020. And immediately after Trump's supporters raided the Capitol, the share of voters who said the GOP was headed in the right direction at the time fell from 32% to 24%, driven largely by Republicans and independents. But now, sentiment about the Republican Party's trajectory is slightly better than it was before January 6. According to the latest data, gathered in December from 2,000 registered voters ahead of the anniversary of the January 6th attack, 34% of all voters now say that the Republican Party is headed in the right direction. Now, that's not a lot. That's not a huge number of Americans, certainly not a majority, but a number that is noteworthy because it is higher than it was before January 6th of last year. Apparently, attacking the U.S. Capitol has made people think better of the Republican Party, at least by 2 points. It's within the margin of error, but it has not, clearly not hurt the Republican brand. The improvement was most notable, of course, among Republicans themselves, 65% of whom say their party is heading in the right direction, up 14 percentage points since January of 2021. So among Republicans, they think they are more on the right track now than they were even back at the beginning of 2021.
I think part of that is because there have been zero consequences. I mean, there have been a few consequences that are serious for some of the low-level people who showed up to run a roughshod over the Capitol, the insurrectionists. But as far as, you know, higher-ups in the Republican Party, Republican politicians, congressional Republicans, there has been zero consequences for them. I mean, corporate media is still welcoming the coup plotters, people who we know, you know, have been, we're part of the top level organizing of the coup attempt.
Let's just have them back on TV and ask them how they feel about Joe Biden's plans for spending.
Gosh, how's that inflation going? You know, so without consequences, then I think that that is part of the reason why so much of the American public doesn't realize so much of the Republican Party was directly involved.
As I said, we have clearly got a lot of work to do this year. But when it comes to that accountability, thankfully, for the first time, I believe I can say in my adult life, it seems that we actually have a committee in Congress, a bipartisan committee in Congress, who seems to get all of this, who seems to understand the need for accountability, and they seem to get it big time. As we begin the new year, the panel, the U.S. House Select Committee, looking into the January 6th attack and more, they have now interviewed more than 300 witnesses. They've collected tens of thousands of documents. They've traveled around the country, we have now learned, in order to talk to election officials who were pressured by Donald Trump, often personally. This, according to AP today, now after 6 months of intense work, the House committee investigating the insurrection is preparing to go public. In the coming months, members of the panel will start to reveal their findings against the backdrop of the former president and his allies' persistent efforts to whitewash the riots and reject suggestions that he helped instigate them. That even after, by the way, a bipartisan 57-43 majority of the U.S. Senate. That includes seven Republican senators nine Republican senators at the time, if I'm remembering it correctly. At Trump's second impeachment trial, they agreed that Trump did exactly that. He incited that attack on the Capitol. It's a bipartisan majority in the U.S. Senate. The committee, the House committee, also faces the burden of trying to persuade the American public that their conclusions are fact-based and credible. But the nine lawmakers on the committee, seven Democrats, two Republicans, are united in their commitment to tell the full story of what happened on January 6th, and they are now planning televised hearings and reports that will bring their findings out into the open. Their goal is not only to show the severity of the riot, but also to make a clear connection between the attack and Trump's brazen pressure on the states and Congress to overturn, yes, to steal AP, to steal Joe Biden's legitimate election as president. Wyoming Congresswoman Liz Cheney, the committee's vice chair and one of its two Republican members, said over the weekend the full picture is coming to light despite President Trump's ongoing efforts to hide the picture. I don't think there's any area of this broader history in which we aren't learning new things, she said. While the fundamental facts of January 6 are known, the committee says the extraordinary trove of material that they have collected, including more than 35,000 pages of records, texts, emails, phone records from people who are close to Trump, that all of that is fleshing out critical details of the worst attack on the Capitol in two centuries, which played out on live television. They hope to fill in the blanks about the preparations before the attack, the financing behind the January 6 rallies that preceded it, and the extensive White House campaign to overturn the 2020 election. AP, to steal the 2020 election. They are also investigating what Trump himself was doing as his supporters fought their way into the Capitol. As of this weekend, we've got an even better idea of that. That, thanks again to Liz Cheney, and yes, firsthand testimony and documents revealing what we had all figured, that he was just sitting there as the Capitol was under attack, as it has not been in some 200 years and has never been at the hands of a domestic mob, as Liz Cheney explained to ABC's George Stephanopoulos.
The committee has firsthand testimony now that he was sitting in the dining room next to the Oval Office watching the attack on television as the assault on the Capitol occurred. We know, as you know well, that the briefing room at the White House is just a mere few steps from the Oval Office. The president could have at any moment walked those very few steps into the briefing room, gone on live television, and told his supporters who were assaulting the Capitol to stop. He could have told them to stand down. He could have told them to go home. And he failed to do so. It's hard to imagine a more significant and more serious dereliction of duty than that.
Is his failure to make that statement criminal negligence?
You know, I think that there are a number of, as the chairman said, potential criminal statutes at issue here. But I think that there's absolutely no question that it was a dereliction of duty. And I think one of the things the committee needs to look at as we're looking at a legislative purpose is whether we need enhanced penalties for that kind of dereliction of duty. But I think it's also important for the American people to understand how dangerous Donald Trump was. We know as he was sitting there in the dining room next to the Oval Office, members of his staff were pleading with him to go on television to tell people to stop. We know Leader McCarthy was pleading with him to do that. We know members of his family. We know his daughter. We have firsthand testimony that his daughter Ivanka went in at least twice to ask him to please stop this violence. Any man who would not do so, any man who would provoke a violent assault on the Capitol to stop the counting of electoral votes, any man who would watch television as police officers were being beaten, as his supporters were invading the Capitol of the United States, is clearly unfit for future office, clearly can never be anywhere near the Oval Office ever again.
Hillary Clinton said a couple of weeks ago that if he runs and wins, that could be the end of our democracy. Do you share that fear?
I do. I think it is critically important, given everything we know about the lines that he was willing to cross. He crossed lines no American president has ever crossed before.
That was conservative Republican Congresswoman Liz Cheney agreeing, by the way, with Hillary Clinton that democracy may be done for if Donald Trump is able to run and win office again in 2024. That was Liz Cheney this weekend on ABC's This Week. She would later go on to say, quote, "I think this is one of the single most important congressional investigations in history." And yes, I believe Liz Cheney is right, which is something that I thought I would never say. Had you asked me back in 2020, would I ever say anything like that? I believe Liz Cheney is right.
Yeah, and she had also said that, you know, she agrees with Hillary Clinton that Trump's return to office would mean disaster for democracy.
Yeah, what was the over-under on that, on Liz Cheney saying, I agree with Hillary Clinton. Yeah.
I know.
By the way, the committee itself, and this is what actually gives me hope here, because you've got Liz Cheney out really taking the lead along with the chairman, Benny Thompson, Democrat from Mississippi. They are working together. They are in lockstep. I don't remember seeing a congressional committee like this, where everyone on both sides are working towards the same goal, where there seems to be no partisan bickering, no fights about what they should and shouldn't do. And everyone on the committee seems to be in full agreement on that. Democratic California Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren, she's a veteran of these sorts of investigations. She was actually a staffer on the House Judiciary Committee during the Watergate investigation of Richard Nixon. She said, quote, "There is no division, no hostility, no partisan bickering. It's like, let's just get the job done." Congressman Pete Aguilar, also of California, fellow Democratic committee member, said, it's good. It's how Congress should be. So that gives me hope. But I'll tell you what, I lie in bed. I actually do this. I know I'm weird. I lie in bed at night pondering ways that, A, Republicans can steal the next presidential election in broad daylight, and B, ways to stop them from being able to do so. And I got to say, so far, I have been unable to come up with a way to stop them. If they decide as a party that they no longer wish to have anything to do with reality, if they simply wish to declare that they won, and they do that in the right states where they control the legislature and where they are more and more controlling the election apparatus itself, if they do that, if they decide to say they won, whether they did or not, if they do that in the states and if they do that in Congress, there will likely, you know, where Republicans, by the way, will also have likely have control of at least one of the two houses by then. If they decide to do that, there is really nothing that can be done to stop them as things are now. And by the way, at the U.S. Supreme Court, which the Republicans have already stolen from the American people, if you're looking at to them as a backstop for this theft, well, don't hold your breath. Unless the federal government, unfortunately, right now, that means only Democrats at this point, since so far zero Republicans have been willing to join in the effort in the U.S. Senate, unless the federal government adopts new election protection laws, including the Freedom to Vote Act, the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, an update to the Electoral Count Act of 1887, unless that happens, and by the way, even if it does, but unless that happens, I see nothing to prevent a Republican Party that is willing to lie about the election and to steal the next presidential election. We'll have a lot to cover in the days and the months ahead and a lot of very difficult work to do in order to save this republic and the planet along with it. But I, you know, like I said, I never thought I would say that, you know, folks like Liz Cheney, that she is giving me at least a modicum of hope. So did an interview, by the way, that our guest host, Nicole Sandler, did last week with our longtime friend and investigative journalist, Marcy Wheeler. She made the argument, contrary to many opinions expressed on this program, including by me, she made the argument that Attorney General Merrick Garland is doing exactly what he should be doing at this point, and that while the House Select Committee is working from the top down, the DOJ is working from the ground up. And Marcy believes that they are both working toward the same goal of accountability for the perpetrators of January 6th, up to and including Donald Trump himself. I don't know if she's right, but she made a hell of a good case, with a hell of a lot of evidence. You can download that that interview with Marcy Wheeler at bradblog.com. It went gangbusters the day that it was released at the blog and at Twitter over the past few over the past week, really. So I was going to ask, what are you hopeful for? What are you hopeful about in the new year? But of course, I've run out of most of my time. I will take a quick break here. We will come back to at least some of your calls at 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. There's a lot to do all at once. So what do you hope comes first, and what are you hopeful will actually come first? Quick break, and we're back with our last few minutes. I'm Brad Friedman, and you are listening to The Bradcast.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
I come to sing a song about hope. In spite of everything ridiculous and sad, though I'm beyond belief, depressed, confused, and mad. Well, I got dressed. I underestimated how much that would take.
No kidding.
I didn't break.
Welcome back to The Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. No time at all, but let's use it. John in L.A., welcome to The Bradcast. Sir, Happy New Year. What's on your mind, my friend? Very quickly. Oh, John.
Me?
Yeah, you, John.
Yeah, okay. There was a debate of a young journalist with his mother. Says, "How do you, what's the evidence for your beliefs that Biden stole the election?" My evidence is my belief. I believe it, therefore it's true. Belief equals evidence. You cannot debate beliefs. Beliefs are will never change, and that's the end of the story. Forget about trying to debate anybody who has belief as evidence.
You're absolutely right, John. Excellent point. And Ted Lieu said, Congressman Ted Lieu from California also said something similar, I think, over the weekend.
147 Republicans voted to not certify the Electoral College results. And more than a year later, not a single one of them can identify who allegedly stole the election, nor explain how it was done. And that's because the election was not stolen.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the problem. No evidence. But apparently, John, I think you're right. It doesn't matter. I believe it was, therefore it was. We would hardly be kicking off the new year correctly if we didn't end the first broadcast of the year with a thought from our old friend Mo in Long Beach. Hey, Morris, well, Happy New Year, my friend. What you got?
Happy New Year to everybody. Happy New Year to everybody. Bradley, not all is lost. The Democrats are getting serious about addressing that filibuster for particular legislation, and they're concentrating on the voting protection. So all is not lost. It's a new year, a new sheriff in town.
I appreciate that hopefulness, Morris. I hope you are right. Thank you, brother. All right, we got to get out. My thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, to my board operator today, Mark Maxwell. Happy New Year to you both. And my thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program, download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. Drop me email if you like. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the Facebooks and the Tweeters, I am The Brad Blog. We will see you there until we see you here next time, hopefully tomorrow. I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.